Welcome to this week's episode of the First Moves podcast. This week, we're talking to Vince Means, a founder, CEO, investor, and someone who's had multiple successful exits, but has also experienced bankruptcy. In this episode, we cover it all, from the highs to the lows, including how Vince's lifestyle once brought him to the brink of losing his life. This episode is a roller coaster, and it's packed with practical information for entrepreneurs. If you want to hear how the pressure of business can truly affect you, then you should listen to this episode. Welcome, Vince. When I read through your LinkedIn bio, it is very impressive. You're a CEO, you're a founder, you're an investor, you have served millions of people internationally, and you've done billions of euros in transactions. That describes your professional career super well. But in a conversation, how would you introduce yourself to people?
I think I'm inherently curious about things in the world. One of the fascinating things for me is that I see a lot of things that other people take for granted. And for me, there's always the question, why is it this way? And I think throughout my life, this endless quest of finding out why and seeing if it can be done better is like my driving force. So I try to apply that in business, in my daily life, and wherever curiosity leads me. Yeah.
And at what age did that question, why, start?
I think from a very early age, I had this realization that, for example, if you have a bucket as a child, this bucket can be anything. It can be a hat, it can be a stage you stand on, it can be a drum. And at one point you reach an age where an adult says to you, this is a bucket, a container for liquid. And all of a sudden you get trapped in this definition that it's only that. And that was for me like a really defining thing, like that it felt like a mental prison, that you start having these fixed definitions of things instead of seeing these open potential perspectives on all the things around you. And so that was the start of my journey. Yeah.
And did you then take this throughout high school as well, then, with the question why? Did you go really deeply into some certain subjects during your school time?
Yeah, I was always driven by curiosity. Also in the school context, it was a challenge, of course, because as soon as I got fired up and obsessive about a topic, then that was the only topic that my interest would go to. And the other 14 topics were were a drag. I think like I was very lucky to grow up in the early days of the internet. And so now it's, of course, a given with Wikipedia or YouTube or Google or ChatGPT, whatever, to find all these things. But back then it was just starting. And so for me, this discovery of just finding the effort that someone took to describe something really specific and then trying it out yourself, that quickly led for me, for example, to software development, like I cannot just use a computer, but I can write code and other people can use what I create. I think this aspect really fascinated me, and in discovering that instead of just consuming things, there's a lot of fun in creating things. And I think that was a guiding force as well. Yeah.
And at what age did you get interested in entrepreneurship?
Actually, in elementary school already.
Okay.
So I have to be fair that I come from a family of, on my father's side, hairdressers, and on my mother's side, florists. So they both had a family shop. For a small SME kind of entrepreneurship, like they of course gave us some valuable input. But the elementary school, at the elementary school, I actually started like this initiative to organize things for my school and for my classmates. So this started out with in Dutch we say speurtocht, like this quest where you go discover something through the woods. I did a survival trip, of course, the school disco with my stereo equipment, trying to be a DJ and selling chips and cola to the rest of the class. And that was good fun. And it kind of escalated to the point where, we started copying things we saw on TV or whatever. So at one point we had a thing where we made an adventure quest, and we thought it would be a good idea to dig a hole as a trap floor, and then one kid walked over it, and of course had to go to the emergency room with with his leg, and that was the end of that that venture.
An abrupt end, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You've since then founded and led a lot of ventures in like many different industries, like fintech, electric mobility, real estate, events. Why so many different things, and how did you get to such a wide range of ventures?
Yeah, I think like for me, the common denominator is always that there's a software component. And that in most cases, everything comes down to connecting supply and demand. So everything has to do with finding an efficient way of connecting those worlds. So in the beginning, I was quite fortunate to specialize in search engines and booking systems, and therefore I got introduced to the travel industry, therefore to mobility, etc. And of course, once you are in those applications, the next step is of course that people need to pay, so you start doing the transactions, etc., etc. And so that was quite a natural progression, where in the end, you just facilitate any kind of marketplace or matchmaking in several domains. And like my main passion is fintech, because I think like in the end, the way we move money around the world is like maybe the truest form of democracy, because that's the real vote of the things we believe in. And so anything that can make that a more connected world where things can get boosted or supported, that's what I want to contribute to. Yeah.
And that's also where you founded or co-founded We Are Blocks?
We Are Blocks. That's like the, so for the crypto kids among us, I was very fortunate in the early days to be early onboarded in the whole Bitcoin movement. So back in the day, it was quite complicated to use a technology like that. So for the non-technical people, it required a very curious string of characters that was like your bank account. And like when you show that to people, people were like, what is this computer code? And it required some dodgy transaction to get your euros into something else. So we saw a big opportunity in the early days to make that kind of user-friendly, that a normal non-technical person should be able to do it. And the timing was very lucky, because after that we kind of had some good momentum from the market, where we were one of the few positioned with such a solution that we had a huge uptake in our user base. So
amazing.
Yeah,
we had someone on the podcast a couple of months ago called Sunny Yang, and she's also with all the blockchain and stuff. We also talked about crypto and how you get into Bitcoin.
Yeah,
and at the moment I was talking with Stein as well, and we don't know anything
about
this. So any way to make it simpler was great. And on the LinkedIn, it's also mentioned it's the biggest app of the Netherlands and Belgium.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's definitely...
It's leading. Yeah, but I exited it. So so one of the challenges for me with the platform is like when we started out, it was mostly about this revolution of the grassroots movement of the people against the traditional institutional world of finance. And I think for me at one point there was a bit of a challenge in that a lot of the users saw it more as a, I say it a bit impolite, but more as a gambling thing instead of really being in the spirit of financing innovation and a change in the world. And that led to me like not feeling too happy about continuing it.
Yeah, so the people were more just putting the money in as a hope it's going to go well.
Yeah, exactly. Without really understanding what they are investing in. And I think like for me, I have a high focus on education. So like that, I think one of the beautiful things about the crypto space and blockchain is that it makes you think about why does money work the way that it works, and why does this lead to certain structures of how society is organized. And I think that quest, at least for me personally, into that topic, it was like something that really captured my curiosity for like 2-3 years to fully understand like this system of how money flows in the world and how that impacts you as an individual. And I I really hope that that is something that becomes more accessible to people to go down that path and to embrace that there are alternatives and that we can run society in different ways. And if we empower technologies like this and adopt it, then we can do amazing things together.
So how do you go from then? So you said you exited this, but you've had so many other things as well. How do you go from exiting one and then just, do you just go straight into the next idea, or do you sit down kind of on the drawing board and you draw a lot of things? Or
no, like it's usually you hit the ground running, that you have a couple of things running in parallel. Oh. And like some of the things you are like the main driving force yourself, and other things you just sit on the passenger seat a bit and see like how things mature to a certain basic level of validation. And then like, yeah, of course, when the tipping point comes, I think for yourself, you always have to explore like where is your value at the best. And as soon as you start repeating the same things too much, I think it's often time to find something new, because life is short. And so it's good to have at least some diverse experiences instead of doing 30 or 40 years exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And often within the life cycle of ventures, you have a lot of ventures that what I call either they lead to nothing or they become like zombie ventures. And zombies you have to shoot.
Yeah.
So you have to execute them. And so I think like throughout my career, like a lot of things didn't lead to anything. So, but that didn't mean you didn't learn or you gained a lot of experience or network or whatever that often contributes to the next thing. And it's quite unpredictable upfront how that's going to play out. But I think even being active in several industries, I take knowledge from something that seems unrelated into the other thing. So it's never wasted. It's just that in hindsight, maybe a couple of years down the line, you realize like, that's why I had to experience that, because it now puts me in a position where I can do this or that or call that person. Yeah.
I'm also a big believer of doing stuff and learning through it. It might flop completely. It might be a huge success. Chances are the first things you begin probably not going to be a huge success unless you hit it right on the nail.
Yeah.
But yeah, chances are that happens are very quite slim.
Yeah.
But I really believe as well that when you get down the line, it's like, okay, those tough months where we're dealing with that problem.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, now we have the same issue. Okay, now it's dealt with in 2 days or something like this, because you already had that experience in your pocket. Yeah.
Yeah, and also like I'm often surprised like the more people you meet along the way, and then you meet them and you think like not that interesting at this point, but then 2 years later you think, this guy, I need to call this guy because he was talking about this. And back then you didn't realize it, but like down the line you realize, okay, I met them for a reason. And it all makes sense the further you go. That's the crazy part. Yeah. And so that's also, I think, about trusting certain things, and that even though the process to get somewhere is very bumpy and unpredictable, overall, if you keep going, it will all start making sense and fall into place. And as long as you learn and you keep engaging external input, like
When you read through your LinkedIn bio, you call yourself an artist and a philosopher trapped in the body of an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Could you dive a little bit deeper into what you mean with that?
Yeah, I think it's a mix that I think especially in entrepreneurship, I also met a lot of people that are very, how to say it politely or impolitely, I think like too capitalistic from what drives them. And so everything becomes about the bottom line instead of having a grander goal for humanity or whatever. Now, of course, I had my own things in that scene as well. But I think it can be quite an emptying thing, because everything becomes about the result and not the process to get there. And that can really distract you from taking joy in the process. And so that's why I really like this thing of an artist where an average non-artist person just sees the result of their work, but the artist enjoys the creation process of it. And so I always try to remind myself that is the biggest joy, not the result of the business. And so that's for me the artist part. And I think also artists have a certain responsibility to society as being like, we live here in a mining region, and in the mines you always had a canary that if the gases in the mines were suffocating people, then the canary would first fall from its stick. So I think artists have a certain responsibility in society to be like the critical alerting mechanism for the zeitgeist of society. And so that's also something that is really embedded deep, like that there is a certain responsibility to alert shifts and to come up with new perspectives for people to realize what is happening. And the philosopher part, I think that again goes back to what I said in the beginning, the why. I think like as a child you have this, I think it's age 4 or 5 where you ask why after every single thing. I think that's also like a good way to always drill down into getting to the essence of things. Like things might be labeled as if it's new or unique, but if you boil down to the basic dynamics of things, it's just a repeating game. And so one of the things for me is that I always make the metaphor of society just being a game. For example, if you compare it to Monopoly, there are so many parallels between reality and Monopoly. But in the end, it's just a game that someone created that somehow we start believing. If it's with Monopoly, you have a rule book. In society, we have laws. But it's just the same dynamic and concepts. It's just that at one point for society, we started believing that these things are fixed and that these are have always been there. But it's just people just created it, just like that Monopoly board. And then, of course, the question comes, what do you do about it if you realize that you accept it for what it is or you start exploring your power to change it? And that's the cool thing. Yeah.
And then we get back to that box again.
Yeah.
The box that you get put inside.
Yes.
You get told, these are the rules.
This yes, exactly.
Follow it like this.
Yeah, yeah.
You've also had multiple successful exits. We already touched upon one of them.
Yeah.
What were the biggest lessons you learned in the moments of the exit and the ones leading up to the exits?
I think like as practical advice for founders, I think like, but it's a bit of cliche. I think like businesses get bought, not sold. Mm-hmm. And so it's always in the perspective of the buyer that the value is perceived. Mm-hmm. But if you try to force it yourself, it's a very difficult, game.
Yeah.
Another thing that I saw from a lot of other entrepreneurs around me is this this dynamic that as soon as you sell, you kind of have an obligation to still maintain a certain leadership for a certain time, so that you kind of make sure that things have a smooth transition. But what you often see, and I saw that with some people really close to me, is that there's so much emotion in what you created. And then as soon as you have to play by someone else's rule, it really starts feeling personal that you have to let go of that. And I really saw that also kind of mentally, I don't want to say destroyed, but at least got to some people in a very heavy way. And I think also for me in my earlier things that kind of... so much of my identity was tied to exactly what I did in business instead of seeing it as a separate thing to let go of. And therefore also at moments when it's not your show anymore or it's a failure or whatever, I always took it very, very personal. And I think that transition for me to take distance from that and just see it in a playful way as something you create, just like this art piece or whatever. And an art piece is also never done. You just stop working on it. All these cliches that an artist has. I think that's a way more relaxed approach. And then you also feel from your energy that these things are a bit like a magnet. If you're like light in it, it also attracts easily that things go well. Mm-hmm. But if you're like very tense and see everything personal, it starts exaggerating that in a loop. And that makes everything a lot crazier and worse. Yeah,
because I can imagine. I mean, I'm just thinking about myself right now with the company that I have. Because I've been building that for 3 years now, which is not very long. But I could see if you built that for 10, 15 years out and you built the team yourself and everything, and then someone comes in and buys it.
Yeah.
I could see myself be emotionally attached to it as well and having a difficult time letting go and letting someone else run the show, and you're just a puppet now that they move around to get done what they need to get done.
Yeah.
What would your advice be to kind of be prepared for that kind of situation when that happens?
I think in the end, it's either like you emotionally make that period short. So you just say like, okay, like normally you have like a period of maybe, let's say a year to 2 years where you still have to transition things. Often you see within 3 months, you see it clashing and et cetera. So I think it's more that if you go into that moment that you kind of nip it in the bud and say like, okay, I take less of a reward in those 2 years, but I make it a shorter period so that I protect myself from that that clash of identity or whatever that you have in letting go of that attachment. I don't know. I think also nowadays, like, is the exit really the holy grail? Like, because then you get back to if you enjoy the process or the result. And maybe that's also like a fully drilled in thing that needs to happen at some point.
Yeah.
But if you're just happy, choose your happiness. And if it's people that you have around you every day that excite you to and you can talk to and you get each other, etc. And it feeds you energy instead of costing you energy, then why let go of it?
Yeah. There's no shame in keeping going with it as well.
No, and I think actually it's very. In these times where everything is like very quick and trend based, etc., like building something that lasts is a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
like where are the long term things? Like everything is a 2 or 4 year cycle of hype, and that's it.
Yeah, like, that's true. That's also where I see a lot of companies. They build up, they grow really fast, especially in the software industry. Yeah. They grow really fast, and then they exit in year 3 or 4, and then you don't really hear them anymore because a big company bought them up, and then it's kind of dead, that little company. Obviously, their tech is used in the bigger company, but you don't hear of them anymore.
Yeah.
On the flip side of the exits and stuff, you also went through a bankruptcy.
Yes, definitely.
How did that affect you? And can you take us into the story of the whole?
Yeah, heavily. Process? So. And this was definitely something I took very personal. So I got into, through the software we made for search engines and booking systems, I got into the travel world. And at one point we also did like flight components, so for airlines, etc. And that kind of got me to a point where I got approached by a platform for private jet bookings that kind of had a challenge in their software to calculate prices for chartered flights, etc. And that led to an opportunity within that space. I didn't know anything about the private jet business, but I understood the dynamics, at least I thought back then, of how to calculate these things, etc. And that kind of put me in a spot where pretty quickly one of the investors in that platform approached me like, hey, can you help out with this? Because I really need to take this to a different level. And then we jumped into it, but it was a challenge. So I think like, of course, the theoretical reality of software is always totally different in the practical reality of the physical world. Yeah. So a lot of things don't go as smooth as you project them to go. And then, I entered an industry like that I was totally new to. So for example, and then in the jet business, I think like one of the first things I thought like, okay, let's see if I can sell a flight to someone. And so selling that flight, it took me like, I don't know, 40, 50 phone calls in my network to find someone that would book a flight with me the first time. And so it started out with just chartering. And then I thought like, okay, this chartering is very incidental from a revenue perspective because I just need to depend upon someone having an actual need. So then I started doing a second business model, which was a pop-up airline where I would do the charter and I would sell the separate seats. So for example, to Formula One or to ski destinations, etc., where there's no traditional line route, I would charter a small aircraft, sell the seats separately. Yeah. And then I tried the third model, which was a subscription-based airline, where you would pay like a fixed fee, and then you could get on board of all the scheduled flights without needing a ticket.
Yeah.
And that one was the mistake. And that because there I had a lot of assumptions about what the behavior would be of people.
Yeah.
And I totally went overboard because I had, like, of course, for the people that took a subscription, a huge obligation for what they should get, and then a huge mismatch in how many seats were actually occupied in the aircraft.
Yeah.
And that kind of blew things, of course, where we kind of lost a lot of money along the way. And that put in the end the company in kind of a deadlock and where you have to make a choice. And that led to the choice for bankruptcy. And then, of course, why I said it before, because it was also a huge period of ego for me. I think, like, I was, of course, very triggered by this world and lifestyle that I didn't grow up in and only saw in movies and TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it very exciting to be in it. And then from an identity perspective of failing in that and being outcast in that, yeah, that of course damaged me from an ego perspective very heavily.
Yeah.
And I felt like, of course, like a failure, and didn't know, like, what is then my path forward and how do you recover from that?
Yeah.
So that led definitely to some depressive episodes.
I can just imagine how that would be. I mean, it's not a fun trajectory to go through at all. Thank you for sharing, by the way.
Yeah.
At what point in the process was it the decision that you sat down with your team and you said, okay, we're going to stop trying this now. Now it's the time that we file for bankruptcy.
Yeah, I think, like, in the end, just to be realistic, it was my financial model that led to the assumptions of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So, and at one point you keep aligning it and you have like this dynamic where you think, like, okay, because there's every week something is changing, you think, okay, we're going to try it one more week, etc. Yeah. But at one point the amounts of money needed to keep the circus going, And the patience you get from everyone for postponing certain targets, yeah, that's something where that starts getting to you. And at one point, of course, we couldn't pay the salaries anymore, and then things start falling apart.
Uh-huh.
And at one point, you cannot schedule the flight that you promise your customers, and then you have to think, like, okay, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And so the first thing was, we discussed with some of our clients, like, okay, what's the situation, and if they can ask if their friends can still join with a subscription to hit our threshold of making things profitable. Of course, you talk to your investors, etc. But in the end, when it starts becoming a sinking ship or a crashing airline, it's very difficult. Like maybe two, three rounds, your investors back you to at least pay for all the operational stuff. But at one point, something drastically has to change. And when that doesn't happen, like, yeah, it's time to call it a day. And I had some really tough conversations back then with people, especially a lot of money was on the table that was lost. And that was a humbling experience. And that in the end led, of course, the challenging thing with the bankruptcy in the Netherlands is that if you're an entrepreneur, you don't get like a full reset from the whole thing. So it's basically, you have to fully earn everything back. And certain things I'm still recovering from. And that's a long, long journey.
Yeah.
And it's actually literally, even though the airline was like many, many years ago, that only 2 weeks ago, the bankruptcy was fully finalized. So because there was still a lot of legal back and forth between certain parties. And so that drags on for years and years and years. And that's also like a challenge because it's constantly in the back of your head that you want these things to have like an ending point and you can continue with life and with energy and creating again.
It's a constant reminder that it's
it's
still there.
Things have a price.
Yeah.
And so that's my responsibility in the end, that I I kind of at one point fully confident said, this is going to work, etc. And please finance this. And then in the end, if it doesn't work, I'm the guy that that definitely created that promise and perspective. And sometimes you're wrong. And then it can be painful. Yeah.
But investors, they know that when they go into to business as well, that it is a risk.
That depends. You have, I think, like the term investor is also a very broad thing. And I think like the fact that someone has money doesn't make them an investor. No. I think there's a big difference in if that money is earned as an entrepreneur, earned with a product, if it's earned through investing in a stock. It's totally different psychologies of how you think about risk and what you think is acceptable from another party. And I think in my early days, I kind of confused people that could make an investment with being an investor. And that might be a bit provoking. But I think that's also for startups a challenge, like to really look for the founders. And then especially the founders that have like the full end responsibility in the venture that they made their money in, because that gives you a totally different perspective towards risk and reality and the challenges you face as an entrepreneur. And I think I had a lot of discussions with people that invested in me, where the more I got to know them, the more I realized, but you didn't go through a journey like that yourself, so what are we discussing here?
Yes, how can you advise me on this if you haven't tried it
like,
yourself?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so for that, I think like there's definitely a group of people that kind of can drink my blood in that sense, because I have a strong opinion on that. And I think it's good to at least, especially if you, like what you say with advising, like, does it come from a point of experience or does it come from a point of theory?
Yeah.
And I think that's also, again, to provoke. I think with a lot of VCs, there are people working that might run the fund or have an analyst role or whatever. But in the end, what's your claim to having your own experience in that?
Yeah.
And then in the end, that's the challenge always with investors. Like if they then become too powerful, they start leading the company instead of the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And that's a tough thing.
That's a scary thought, actually, that you get a big investor on board who haven't had any experience at all.
Yeah.
And then they take controlling interest at some point in the company.
Exactly.
That's a scary thought, actually.
And they start steering you from a theoretical perspective of having the abstracted view of seeing your company as a couple of Excel sheets that get reported on a weekly basis and think that that is then the full oversight of what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I think often as an entrepreneur, you're in so much dialogue with your end users. You have a grand mission, and the Excel sheet only comes at the end.
Yeah.
It's only the result of what you're doing here. And that's the part that is difficult to translate often in a structural way towards your investors. Yeah,
definitely. Oh, I wanted to ask as well, because a lot of people, when you talk about bankruptcy, they will look at you in a different way.
Yeah.
How did people around you react to the business failing?
Yeah, it depends on the kind of people. I think like you have like people that have an employee background, they definitely see it as failure and they are quite judgmental. And I think like and you have this term as persona non grata or whatever, like they think about their reputation or whatever. So that's, of course, quite funny to see how superficial that is.
Yeah.
And then you have like people that have tried some things themselves in their lives. They often think, okay, you failed, but what did you learn?
Yeah.
And how long are you going to sit with your own pity and self-sorrow? And when are you going to get back up? And what are you going to do next? And then often you start seeing like at one point, if you start getting back up, these people start cheering for you. And then as soon as the whole risk is out of it, this first group again starts joining you.
Yeah.
And I think like also realistic, just to fully be transparent in my case, I also got into a really depressive episode. And I also had a lifestyle that was quite fucked up, just to be fully transparent. With this whole jet business, I came into a party lifestyle that was ridiculous. So
maintaining clients and stuff.
Yes, and it was like almost the same year that Wolf of Wall Street came out. So that was kind of the life.
The way of doing things.
Yeah, that I was doing. And so that kind of took a huge toll also on me mentally and physically. Yeah. And at one point... that also became almost fatal to me. So,
Yeah, because you also mentioned that you've had major challenges with your health.
Yeah.
On your LinkedIn, there's a period of 3 years where it's written a career and well-being break.
Yeah.
Was that following this?
Yeah, exactly. So I had at one point that my intestine got ruptured.
Okay.
And so this came from my... I forgot what it's called in English. The alvleesklier.
The gland. The
organ that kind of made that happen. And that was, of course, because of living a too crazy party lifestyle. Yeah. And that kind of fucked me up because, like, literally my intestine kind of exploded in my belly cavity with all the acids and the shit from the intestine.
Yeah.
And that started damaging my organs from the outside, and they started getting infected and growing together, and that almost had me die. So I first laid in a coma for quite some time, and then in the end they started recovering my intestine as good as they could, and that was a wild time, and. That also literally had me face death multiple times because, like, it was, it was just too fucked up at that point. And so I went, like, I'm a big guy, so I'm normally like 105 kilos, and like because my digestive tract didn't work, I totally shrunk down to 48 kilos, and just bones, and I laid in a bed for a year and a half. So also my muscle mass was gone. I couldn't walk. My digestive tract didn't work. And they basically kept me artificially alive by injecting this food into my heart chamber, like this liquid food directly in the blood. And it kept deteriorating. And at one point, I had euthanasia planned, which you can do in the Netherlands. Because it was basically clear that I don't know, had like maybe 10 more weeks, and I could barely still have any quality of life. And then I had like a kind of like a, you know, Burning Man. I had like a kind of funeral setting with my friends and family where I said goodbye to everyone. And the week after the euthanasia was planned, and then... it was a beautiful ending. So emotionally also I said goodbye to everyone. Uh-huh. And I accepted my the end of my life. And then like in that week, a surgeon from another hospital, it's a whole story, it's too much I think for this episode, but a surgeon gave me again an outlook and said like, okay, I want to try rescuing you by doing this and this, but it takes X amounts of weeks. You have to survive until this point. It was Dr. Belgers from Sittard. Shout out to Dr. Belgers. That gave me an outlook again. And then in the end, like they removed a certain amount of my intestines and other damage. And all of a sudden I walked out again and I had to restart my life, even though I already accepted death. And so the first period, I felt like an alien back on Earth. Yeah.
Almost like a ghost that came back to
life. Yes, yes, yes. So that was very wild. And I had a lot of support from my family, specifically my aunt. She took me in my with the hospital bed in her living room, guiding me through the last stages of my life back then. So it was quite exceptional. Yeah.
And that must be such a weird out-of-the-body feeling.
Yeah, totally. Kind of,
you're saying bye.
Yeah.
To your family, knowing that it's a week.
Yeah.
But then it also must be a crazy victory feeling walking out of the hospital again.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. If you see these, I literally have videos of these things. It's crazy, but even to go back one step, I had like in this coma phase, I had like the weirdest experiences because I had like I had three major things I can remember because it's just like a giant dream that goes on for weeks and end. So the first thing I had to do with that my whole life has been about technology, and within the coma dream, I all of a sudden got like this Terminator-esque fear of technology. So I kind of had like this whole nightmare scenario with AI and robotics going crazy. Okay. So that kind of fully put me off for anything tech related for a long time after that. And now I'm back to the tech dark side. That was humiliating because everything I believed in with tech, the tech could solve everything, I all of a sudden got afraid of. The second thing was I had like I was in a, it sounds cliche, in a big tunnel, and there was nothing behind me, and in front of me was only a door, and I knocked on this door, and there was only a voice at the other end that said, "Who's there?" And I said, "Yeah, it's Vince Mains, this, that, blah 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 blah." Door stayed shut. Yeah, and so I thought, okay, I'm gonna knock this door again. And I'm Vince Mains, blah, 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 blah. Door stays shut. This continues for many, many times. And this door stays shut until I kind of get tired from it. And I just answer only my name. I don't explain anything anymore. And the door opens up. And that was for me a realization, I think, like from a salesperson perspective, where in the past I was always extremely trying to come up with arguments or sell something or whatever, and I think for that the message was like, okay, it's good enough to be yourself or some cliche like that. And then I had one third experience, a quick one, was that there was a woman standing in front of a door with a butterfly shaped mask, very specific again, and I got to talk to her, and I asked her like, what's behind the door? And she said, "Yeah, it's a butterfly party." And I said, "Okay, but can I get in?" She said, "No, because you're still a caterpillar." That was really
okay. Really,
yeah. So I found that I thought about that one specifically very, very long. Like I found that a good reality check. And then in the end, I woke up so out of the coma, and it was the middle of the night, and they took out my lenses. I have -5 point something. And so I woke up, and I just saw the lights flashing, and I couldn't see where I was, and I was fully disoriented. And then, I basically thought, okay, this is the Matrix thing. Like, I'm waking up in the bathtub. And then this nurse hovered over me. "So, Mr. Mains, you know what day it is?" And then I knew, okay, I'm back. back in the old world. Yeah. So that was quite a mind fuck. Yeah.
What a crazy story.
Yes. Yeah.
And did these dreams like go on repeat almost?
Yeah, they kind of seem endless. I think if I would describe it to other people, at least from my experience, is that I was just in this very long state of REM sleep. And that's usually the dream state. And so for me, it felt like a dream of weeks or maybe months, whatever, in my perception. A lot of these things, they ponder on in your brain for the next years that you kind of have flashbacks or memories to what you experienced in that dream.
Yeah.
It's really weird. Yeah, yeah.
And this is then where you created like the shift in the kind of work you do afterwards as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think like for me, as you might have noticed with this topic with investors and stuff, I think like I made a lot of compromises in the past about my things just to get the result.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm now at a point where I might be a bit more annoying to some people. Opinionated, but I make sure that I'm doing it with people that I believe in, that give me energy, instead of feeling that I corrupt myself just for some things that are not my energy givers. And I think in the past it was a lot was ego driven, because a lot had to do with status, a lot had to be about being seen, like this cliche of the unseen child, and then you try to manifest it as crazy as possible to be as loud as possible.
Get the flashy cars, the flashy watches, the clothes.
And that's still like my pitfall, because I still, in that sense, want that validation or whatever. And that's cliche. Like a guy I once met, he asked me, "What's your earliest childhood memory?" And I'll tell you who you are. Because it's usually like this a traumatic thing or whatever that gets exaggerated into your operating system of why you do things. And that's a crazy path.
How long after this everything happened did you say, okay, now it's time to get back to doing stuff you like again and to work?
Yeah, it took a while. I came back out of the when I had my final surgery, I still had to say goodbye in case I didn't make it. Mm-hmm. And then basically it went well. I woke up and it took me, I think, like 10 days to walk out of the hospital. And so then, of course, like this energy starts going, because I spent like, I think like more than a year and a half in this hospital. And the crazy thing was, I also had this hospital bacteria thing, this BMRO MRSA. Yeah. So I was in like this isolation kind of vibe. So I felt like being in an aquarium so I didn't have fresh air, I didn't have sunlight. I was just in a fucking aquarium for.
And your family can't come into you, they stand
on
the other side.
They have to have these suits and stuff. It was ridiculous. And I understand it, of course. So it was so surrealistic for me to be out again. And I had to learn to walk again, literally, because my muscles were fucked. So I had like a super good physical therapist that helped me to learn to walk again. And this started with like these elderly things, doing 10, 15 steps up to, in the end, like climbing stairs, etc. And then you have to learn to trust yourself again to drive a car.
Oh,
really weird.
Yeah.
I had to learn to eat again, because I think like for more than a year, I didn't eat.
Yeah, you had the tube.
I didn't eat or drink. Everything went through lines. Mm-hmm. So this was also weird. Like it's like if you do a super long fasting, but the psychological element of not having the habit of eating and drinking is a total mindfuck.
Yeah.
So that's also weird. So for me to get the joy back of food, was super weird. So for me, it really felt as really learning it again as a baby, all these things.
You have to like learn how to swallow and stuff like that again.
Yeah, like but also to enjoy it, because you don't have the trigger or the sensation that you used to have, because a lot of eating is habitual.
Yeah,
weirdly enough, and so I really had to build it up again, like to enjoy it. And because, for me, it was just nutrition or something. Very weird, yeah.
What was the thing you craved the most after this kind of stuff, just to eat like a proper
food? Yeah, so of course, fat food. It's super cliche. Yeah. Here locally, we have this bullshit frikadel special and frit survlees thing. So that was really on the agenda. Like, but the crazy part was, so I had like two big holes, like these colostomy bags, or how you call it.
Yeah.
So of course you eat it and it instantly comes out. So the joy of eating it, and then it's in the back, and that was it. So that was also mentally a very weird thing.
But at least you got the taste of it.
You got the taste. Yeah, exactly. So that was something, and I think like for me, I had a lot of support, so it was for me good to see my friends again in a non-hospital context. That was a really big thing, and to just do things lightly and for fun again. And for quite some time, I constantly had to carry like these colostomy bags, and it would produce like 4.5 liters of fluid every day. It was ridiculous. And then I had like this astronaut backpack with all the food with these tubes going in. And so as soon as that was really over, then it really started, and I started regaining my confidence in daily life. And then, but in the end, I got fully reset. So I I was put under medical conservatorship, so I couldn't do anything. I was put, how do you say it? I couldn't even use my own signature or pay for something. Everything was taken over by conservatorship. And then I had to regain that. And first thing I had to do, like 3 months after I came out of the hospital, was deal with three, in Netherlands we have BV's, mm-hmm. which are like corporate entities.
Limited liability companies.
Yeah. So I had three bankruptcies 4 months after I came out of the hospital that I had to deal with. So that was a weird experience, like because I still had like all these things.
Yeah.
And with the boxes of the administrative folders you go to court to apply for the bankruptcies. So that was a thing. And yeah, and then I really had to build everything up again and build like a whole life from scratch. And so I started with nothing again and build it up. And luckily I had some people around me that that believed in me and supported me in it. And I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah. So that's climbing the ladder again from the bottom.
Yes, it's, exactly.
Getting up again.
Exactly.
And is that the relationship that you say you have a black belt in life experience? Is that then?
Yeah, I think if I really start sharing like the things that serendipity wise turned out still okay despite how crazy they seemed in the moment, then at one point I kind of feel relaxed about whatever life throws at me, and do it from a position of just accepting it instead of resisting it. And I think that's maybe for me what I call the black belt experience. Like at one point you get a certain rest or acceptance of these things, and that makes a lot of things towards the future a lot easier. That used to stress me out a lot. I used to be like, in Dutch we say stresskip. Like a stress chicken. Mm-hmm. I could get stressed out a lot about things. And I don't want to say I'm fully weightless now, but I kind of feel relaxed and
And actually more at ease with it.
More at ease, and I see the fun of things again instead of taking it so serious. And
I think that's good you say that, see the fun of things, not taking it so seriously, because I'm definitely the one that takes it way too serious. Cause,
stress kip.
Yeah, 100% at the moment I am. And it's affecting my sleep. It's affecting the way I eat, everything. It's getting affected by it. And my parents, they keep on saying, and now you slow down a little bit. But then it's like, no, but tomorrow we have the deadline and this and this and this, and we have to do that and then that. And I think getting the bigger picture of everything and just sometimes being able to say, okay. Yeah. It's actually not so bad if you take 2-3 hours off tonight. It's fine.
Nothing crazy happens.
Nothing crazy, no. Yeah. And I think learning that, it's important, not knowing that not the whole company's going to fall apart if you take a day or two off. Or
no, but like in the end, everyone benefits from you feeling good and being able to continue it. And you can stress out about the short-term stuff, but in the end, you're working on something greater than yourself. And you only get there by surviving yourself properly. And this cliche of health being your greatest wealth, it's really true. And the people that really care about you, they will support you in that anyway. And the people that don't care about you, they might be very judgmental when you take time for yourself.
Yes.
Because they,
And that's also knowing your friends and knowing who are the people there for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then also the art of saying no. I think like in the... also for me, this is a huge pitfall always. I'm so triggered by everything. And I love saying, I will fix it or I will do it.
Yeah.
But you only have 24 hours. And how much of the things that you do really need to be done by you? And that's something, be mindful of it. And you don't have to do everything. Yeah.
You also offer free consultancy for young or aspiring founders. And this is part of a feel of you giving back from all the experience you've learned. And I also see now you're uniquely qualified to give a lot of this advice to people because you have been through it pretty much through it all. Actually, you've done exit, you've had bankruptcy, you've done multiple companies.
Yeah.
Is this really like a big part of you as well now that now you've done all these things, you want to start giving back as well through doing these things for founders?
I think like in the end, success is a team sport.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, like back in the day here at UM, for example, we had like the startup weekends and the startup pirates, and we started this initiative, Founders Club. I don't know if it still exists.
It might.
Okay, yeah, and this entrepreneurship week and all these things. So, but the fact that we had a certain accountability towards each other, how you described it before the podcast, of having these conversations constantly with people that are in the same energy, that somehow discover other things than you, that you can learn from, it's a mutually beneficial thing. So it's not about me giving back. It's that if I talk to you, you know a lot of things that I don't know that I can be triggered by and that might show me a blind spot I have, and I can do it for you. And so this mutual exchange, I think it's good. And especially if you do it with a younger generation than your own generation, is because the perceived reality is totally different. Like you live in a different mind space than maybe me, who's 15 years older, because we have a different frame of reference of how the world works, etc. And in the end, it moves more and more, of course, every time to the younger generation. So I can't be stuck in my thinking. And then if I zoom back on the games, certain games stay the same. So they are, I don't want to say eternal, but they can be, you can get distracted by the temporarity that something looks unique, but they've been the same in my generation or the generation before me. And that's often the beauty of sparring with different generations.
Yeah, sure. And you also invest in I'm guessing startups and stuff. When you look at what to invest in, what are the criteria you have for investing something? Is that influenced by all the experiences you've had for now?
Because
you
said that
you can be a bit difficult when dealing with for certain stuff.
Yeah, no, I think like for me in the past, I used to think it was a lot about the specific product, or if the pitch deck had this perfect slide, and I would spend hours on all this bullshit. But now I feel more and more that it's about the person that I have in front of me. And it's about gaining trust that that person knows more about this domain than me, and that that person is humble enough to understand their own shortcomings. And once you start tapping into that and you gain that trust, that you will fix anything you know about your domain of problem that you're focusing on with your venture, then you will solve anything. And I think like if you look at a cliche pitch deck or whatever, it's usually like a snapshot of a perceived perspective that doesn't tell the story for me. And I find that often irritating, even in the traditional fundraising scene, that everything gets reduced to just that. And it gives a false idea, I think, often that an investor can then say, like, of course, it's about focus, which that part I agree with, but it's just a snapshot of a perspective. Yeah. And this whole story you only get by doing a proper dialogue, understanding why somebody started this. It's the most important question. Yeah. Why? Why do you do what you do? And is that driving your commitment in such a fearful way that you're more obsessed about this topic than anyone
else?
That's what I want to feel. And then, like, of course, it's good if you focus on a problem that really is not just about cliche capitalism, but something that either helps the environment or society or anything that makes the world a bit more beautiful instead of just shareholder value.
Yeah, I definitely think that point is also true, because when obviously we're looking for investors for Unshackled, the glove company that I have, and when we send a LinkedIn message, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, that you send a LinkedIn message saying, hey, my name is Sebastian, we're doing this, this is our pitch deck.
Yeah, it's bullshit.
But all they see is the 8 or 10 slides that we sent to them with a bunch of information on it, and it's all very much up to their own interpretation, because the way we write things, we write it in a way where we think we get across what we want to get across, but an investor might read it and think something else of it, because it's all up to perspectives and cultures and all these different kind of things. So I fully agree with that. The conversation is the best way to kind of just
get in dialogue, because otherwise you totally flatten the soul of what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
And the soul is the people behind it.
Yeah.
And as soon as you get into a dialogue between people instead of a reduced flat reality, it's like a screen. It's just like a two-dimensional version of what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
I think that doesn't tell the story.
And there's no depth in it.
There's no depth and no soul. Like, I don't feel the warmth.
Yeah.
And in the end, it's the fire and the entrepreneur that gets the venture going.
Yeah, exactly.
And even if you're a junior founder, the beautiful thing is, like, if you're motivated enough, you will find people that will guide the way. And I'm often surprised that anybody, if they feel your passion, anybody shares their secrets with you, because they know how rare it is that someone is so motivated and so focused, and they are cheering for you because they recognize themselves in you. And you'll be surprised how many doors open if you do that from an authentic position, instead of like, hey, here's my pitch deck and please give me money. Like, that's a very flat, it's almost like how you would pay a stripper. You just give the cash and do the show. There's no soul in the in the interaction. And that's something why I think, just invest in the people from a human to human perspective before you start talking about these things. Yeah.
And how would you want to be approached then? Because you say, like, with an authentic way of approaching and more like conversation style.
Like this, like, let's have a coffee or a drink. Tell me your story. Like,
so just a message on social.
The pitch that comes later. Like, the thing is, for me, like, once we go into dialogue, I can quickly see, like, if you're authentic, if you're doing it for reasons that are bigger than just chasing some quick win or... I recognize ego more than anyone else because I have a huge ego myself. So I know what to look for. so that's the thing. And then once that authentic vibe around that mission and your own motivation and why it's your personal story.
Yeah.
And that's also like in your case, that it's a story of your girlfriend and her family and your own family. It's a personal story.
Yeah.
And that's way different than someone that says, that's an industry where you can make a lot of money. Yeah. Let's go into that industry.
Yeah.
Go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
Like, have fun. But that's not something I'm interested in. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And how would you get to the point? Like, let's say I would approach you outside of this. Mm-hmm. How would I get to get a cup of coffee with you? Is that just texting somewhere? Or?
Yeah. The only thing with me is often I have a lot of communication, so I'm really shitty in follow-up. so for me, it's always if you're persistent. So maybe the first time I don't get to it, but by the second or third time, I usually think like, I saw that before. I need to get back to that person and I'll make it happen. So I'm always happy to at least explore what is there. And it must have a reason why you're motivated to talk to me. And then it also helps, of course, like if you make a bit of effort in understanding my why. Like, why am I doing what I'm doing? Yeah. And that's something that you resonate on. Yeah. And that again brings me back to this story before. Like, don't confuse just that someone has money as that is your investor. No, in the end, it's a partner, someone that somehow... needs to feel this vision that you have and this mission and believes that that's something that they want to contribute to themselves.
Yeah.
And the financial aspects are the result of doing that successfully. Like,
super interesting.
Yeah,
because I think that's what a lot of people, at least of the founders that I talk to and the friends that I have in the office and stuff, they're scared for doing that. They're scared for reaching out to go and talk to people because it's quite easy to sit behind your laptop and just type a message and send your pitch deck.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of done. But through the experience I see is also with the persistency.
Yeah. It's,
you don't get anything by just doing it once. You have to keep going. Obviously, it can be annoying if you send 16 emails to the same person and you still don't hear anything. But you have to, at some point, you have to keep going as well. That's also what makes a founder.
But I think, like, it's very simple now in this TikTok generation. You have this guy walking up to people on the street, like asking you how they made their first million.
Yeah.
And if you look at his first videos, it's just random people or whatever. But I think just in a matter of a year and a half, he's talking to the billionaires.
Yeah.
And all he did was consistently ask 500 or 1,000 people to get to that point.
Yeah.
And it's just, you don't have to go to Beverly Hills or whatever. You can do it digitally nowadays. You'll be surprised how many high-end people reply to their emails.
Yeah.
If the email is short and quick, and if it's a pitch deck and something that takes a lot of time to react to, very complicated because they need to reserve time and they don't have it. It's the scarcest thing. But if it's just one or two lines and a quick reaction, or something that you can bring of value to them, that's cool. Like, in the end, it's just building these relationships often before you get to the point of asking something.
Yeah, nurturing them a bit as well.
Nurturing and genuinely being interested in what they have to say. Like, otherwise, you only come to get. And I think, like, for a lot of senior entrepreneurs or people with a certain experience in life, they're often surprised that they don't get asked by people, how did you do it? And they're very happy. And that's why I mentioned this guy that asks on the street. A lot of these guys honestly never really get the question to explain themselves properly because nobody's listening.
No.
There are very few people that want what they have based on the effort they need to do it. They want the result,
but there are
very few that want to understand the how and want to understand the struggle and the path that gets you there. And that's the fun part. And and once you tap into that, it's very authentic that people start opening up and they want to share every detail with you.
Yeah. That's the thing that Alex Hormozi said with everyone wants the view, but no one wants to climb.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's also a great example with that.
You talk about changing the operating system of our society.
Yeah.
What in your opinion is the glitch right now in the operating system and how would you like to change it? We talked a little bit about it beforehand, but...
Yeah, I think like this metaphor I made with Monopoly, I think it's for me the simplest way to describe it. But in the end, like the world is now divided into 200 game boards. Eh? Like, and one is born in this one and one is born in that one, etc. And that's the part you couldn't choose. Yeah, it's just something that happened to you. Maybe spiritually you have chosen where you want to be born. But and that gives us certain advantage or disadvantage that we somehow confuse with our own effort or merit or whatever. And I think that's for me like one of the things that I rebel against and where anything we can do to create an even playing field. And this is on the level of identity. This is on the level of money. This is on the level of leverage you can have on things. There I see a huge opportunity in, like, for example, if you say with crypto that any person in the world can transact to anyone without any party in between having an opinion about it or stopping it, very powerful.
Yes.
Yeah. It's the same with simple things that we can, of course, send messages or email. Like we start building these basic infrastructure things where everything becomes directly peer-to-peer instead of having these huge centralized bullies in between that somehow try to take a chunk of it or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's the main thing that's happening now. And then, of course, I'm not a fan of AI myself, but... of course, that the knowledge aspect gets leveled now, at least the access part.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great great thing. And I think like it's a bit of a side story, but I think like also the whole passport question, like now people are locked with a certain nationality, etc. It's also eroding. What you now have for the rich where they buy two or three nationalities... Oh. It's also going to become a commodity, I expect.
They buy Malta because then they have access to everything.
Yes, and I think it's just going to be like a gym membership where you say, okay, for these activities, it sounds really stupid maybe to say it like that, but I don't know how sustainable it is to keep the old structures. I think everything will start moving more and more towards a choice by someone to choose it instead of being forced into it. And the competition is getting so high between... local physical interest versus global demand that people start shopping for these things more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope therefore for people that want to have a different context to thrive in that becomes a more even playing field in the near future. Yeah. And that's also, I think in regards to capital, that's the beauty now, whether it's through AI or through crypto or these other things, like the barriers to do something become lower and lower.
Yeah.
So in the end, the question is, what's your excuse? If you can access it and whether it's for funding in the past, you needed to go to Silicon Valley. Now you can do it almost from any spot in the world.
Yeah.
If knowledge, you needed to have like the specialized knowledge workers in region X, now you can access it from any village in the world.
And yeah.
So I think you will see a mass decentralization of the people that make change. And where in the past it also used to be concentrated spots in the world. And I hope therefore that we will start really seeing very weird, not per se unicorns in the sense of business, but unicorns in the sense of system change happening from regions that you don't expect, because they have a totally different perspective than the people living in the bubble of Amsterdam or Silicon Valley or whatever, and don't look outside of it. But the most of the world is outside of these bubbles. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the power shift might happen. Yeah.
And it might just take one place to change first, and then everyone sees, okay, that actually works, and then it might change down. It just takes that one place to
And I think in the end, the scary negative side is that corporations now become so wealthy. If you have NVIDIA now being 4 trillion or something, these companies are literally able to buy countries now. So I'm just waiting for the day where Apple announces like, hey, we're going to buy country X and make it like the first corporate country. And that reminds me a bit of this industrial time with the mining here in the region, where the mining company owned the village, they owned the shops, they owned the sports clubs, they everything. So it can also go in a shitty direction. And now is the time where we can still shape it, and let's steer it towards the positive thing of having these decentralized alternative power structures.
Create the balance.
Because if we go down the centralized route, I think it's going to be a scary future. Yeah.
It can get scary very quickly when you think about it that way.
Yeah.
Because then you lose all control on anything pretty much.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Or you give one company.
Yeah, I think, of course, Mr. Altman and Mr. Musk and all these types are after that. Like this mass organized, centrally controlled kind of things. And I don't know. It's not my favorite thing.
And only time will tell whether it happens or not.
Exactly. I think in the end, humanity always goes for the good. Like if you look at history, we had shitty times, but every time humanity persists and survives and it changes form and shape and preference and whatever, but we're still here.
Yes.
And so I believe in the resilience overall, despite all the shitty local situations and things. And so from an optimism perspective, I believe the future will always be better than the past.
Yeah. I think so too.
Yeah.
I think so too. So as a closing tradition on the podcast, we ask all of our guests to bring an object that means a lot for them in their life, in their career life.
Yeah.
What did you bring for us?
Yeah, so for me, this is the Uruburu snake. It's a snake that eats its own tail.
Okay.
And it's, of course, about the message of that destruction is creation. And so in the end, always to make room for something new, you have to let go of something else in a weird way. So it's not about accumulating more and more and more. It's about just shifting it. And you have to let go of the attachment. And I think that's, for me, always a great reminder that, great that I'm making progress here. But in a way, you also have to make a bit of a sacrifice at something else. Yeah. And that's the reality of this balance of this operating system of society, I think, with a lot of things, where as soon as something just wants to accumulate, it brings everything out of balance.
Yeah.
And
For sure. It's also a great thing also for business-wise. It's also with the focus.
Exactly.
You can't have six different things going on at the same time.
Exactly.
You can have maybe one or two, but it needs to be focused on that as well. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
No? Exactly. Yeah. So always think about the snake.
So you always carry that with you?
Yeah, I always carry it with me. And the second thing is this thing, maybe as a short side quest. It's I once was at a party and this random guy showed up to me with like an Alice in Wonderland hat.
Yeah.
And he gave me this coin and he said, what's your number? I said, why? He said, one day you're going to get a call with an address and you have to show up with this coin. Yeah. Fucking genius. And so I was like, okay, sounds interesting. And in the end, it's called the lineage. And what this guy did, he would just find contrasting characters on the street or in a club or in some conference or at uni or whatever. And he would just create random events where he would let all these characters clash by bringing them together at random points and just see whatever happens. And it was really genius because you had like all kinds of people that maybe daily wouldn't meet all of a sudden in a room together and starting all kinds of really cool stuff. And so for me, I find this guy a serendipity engineer because he just hacked the networking game.
That's such a fun way to do that.
Yeah, but please apply it in your daily life. Yes. And you'd be surprised with all these random people, like what comes out of it. Yeah. You can never predict it, but it's going to be magical.
Yeah.
And there you have to trust the randomness or the chaos of serendipity.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Vince. Yes, Thank you for sharing your story.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to our episode. If you want to connect with our guest personally, then give us a follow on LinkedIn at First Moves. We also have an Instagram at First Moves Podcast. And lastly, we ask you to leave a review. This will enable us to bring better guests on board and give you better content in the future. Have a nice day.